All right, hello everybody, and welcome to Hope Trading. I am, as our recording has started, I'm going to start off with some housekeeping, with a review of our housekeeping for here for today. So, as I said, this training is being recorded and will be offered on demand for those not able to join us live. All of our archive trainings are available on the ClueWin website under Archive Trainings, so you can find them all there and browse other training opportunities. The ClueWin training page that brought you today to the webinar also has the PowerPoint slides and PDF for you to download and to use at your, you know, if you would like to slide through them at your own leisure. At any point today, if you have any questions or any technical issues, please use our Q&A pod to submit those. We will have two question and answer breaks during today's training where we will address those questions in the Q&A pod live. For those interested in receiving a certificate of completion, they will be available at the end of the training here today when you complete the feedback form. Once you complete the form and click a box to certify that you participated today, a certificate will be provided to you. On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training, ITRC Strategies for Preventing and Managing Harmful Cyanobacteria Blooms. My name is Devin Sechkar. I'm your moderator today from Arlington, Virginia. This training is an introduction to the ITRC online guidance document of the same name produced by ITRC in 2021. Today's training is sponsored by the ITRC and is hosted by the US EPA Cleanup Information Network, also known as CLUIN. The Interstate Technology is a program of the Environmental Council of States. ITRC is a state-led organization composed of members from state agencies, federal government, the private sector, academia, and community stakeholders. ITRC members participate in technical teams, which produce tools, resources, and training courses, such as the one you're participating on today. Our full ITRC disclaimer is available on our website. If you do plan to use ITRC materials, we ask that you review that policy in detail and be sure to credit ITRC accordingly. ITRC is partially funded by the US government. ITRC nor the US government warranty the materials nor endorse any specific products. So before I turn this over to our expert speakers, I just would like to set the stage with some general information. So why is it important to have a guidance document focused on cyanobacteria? Excuse me. Cyanobacteria are native species found in nearly every type of aquatic environment, lakes, rivers, wetlands, even damp soil. In lakes, ponds, and rivers, they can become very abundant, forming masses of cyanobacteria known as blooms. Under some conditions, they may also produce compounds harmful to people and animals called cyanotoxins. Every year, locations around the U.S. report blooms that have been linked to human illnesses and in some cases to animal deaths. This causes impacts to recreation, drinking water, farming, and wildlife. Current science indicates that the future is bright for cyanobacteria. Environmental conditions around the world are increasingly expected to move towards those that cyanobacteria love. A warming climate means longer growing seasons and warmer lakes in areas that don't normally have them. Increasing precipitation means that more surface runoff reaches our waters, and that runoff is expected to carry more of those nutrients cyanobacteria needs to grow. So more places to live and lots of food to grow. We need to be thinking about steps that we can and that we need to take in order to make it more difficult for cyanobacteria to grow. The ITRC guidance document built on the extensive experience of our HCB team members from 2018 to 2020. Team members represented federal, state, and local experience, natural resources, and public health staff and scientists, as well as people living in those communities that are affected by these cyanobacteria blooms. Not everyone has experienced or responded to HCBs in the same way, and having these diverse perspectives was key to building this guidance document. The team discussed what worked, what didn't, and what aspects of cyanobacteria management are important to consider. The ITRC team purposely brought all aspects of cyanobacteria responses together into one document. The ITRC document shares successful approaches used around the country and links you to resources that you can explore as you learn more about cyanobacteria management and response. So on slide 8 here, I have the pleasure of introducing our expert trainers here today. They are going to cover 5 topics in cyanobacteria management and response. So to start us off here today, I'm going to pass it over to Gina La Liberté with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, and she's going to start us off with an introduction to cyanobacteria. All right, take it away, Gina.
Great. Thank you. Thank you for joining us today. So I'm going to be reviewing the HCB introduction, which you can find in Section 3 of the HCB guidance document. I'm going to be giving a brief introduction to cyanobacteria biology and ecology. I'm going to review the terminology that's used in the guidance document, and I will briefly go over the health concerns that are associated with HCBs and as well as some current regulations and guidance. All right, trying to go forward. There we go. So just to start with some basic information about cyanobacteria, they are naturally occurring and are widely distributed across both aquatic and terrestrial environments. In the guidance document, we focused on those in freshwater and estuary habitats. They do have some beneficial ecological roles, such as serving as a food source for other organisms, providing oxygen via photosynthesis, and some are able to fix atmospheric nitrogen into a form that's usable by algae and plants using specialized cells that you see indicated by the arrow. Cyanobacteria have some unique characteristics that help them to form persistent blooms, including forming resting or dormant stages, such as this enlarged cell that you see indicated by the second arrow. Planktonic cyanobacteria, which float in the water column, can regulate their buoyancy using the gas vesicles that you see as the dark bodies in the cell indicated by the bottommost arrow. So what do cyanobacteria look like, and how can you tell them apart from other green things in aquatic systems? We have a great visual guide to common harmful cyanobacteria in Appendix A of the guidance document, as well as a video on how to identify cyanobacterial blooms. The visual guide has field photographs of blooms and microscopic images, and it covers cyanobacteria by what form they grow in, such as in colonies or filaments, and by what habitat they grow in, such as planktonic in the water column versus benthic, attached to surfaces or on sediments on the bottom of aquatic habitats. The guide also includes examples of things other than cyanobacteria, such as plants, filamentous algae, and other kinds of algae, as there are many other things that can be mistaken for cyanobacteria. So now I'd like to review some of the terminology that we use in the guidance document. So when we're talking about cyanobacteria, we're talking about blue-green algae. Cyanobacteria is a more scientific term, since cyanobacteria are actually true bacteria that photosynthesize, and the group considered to be algae can encompass things other than bacteria. It's important to remember that not all harmful algae blooms, known by the acronym HABS, H-A-B-S, are harmful cyanobacterial blooms, for which they use the acronym HCBs, and which you may have seen elsewhere as cyanohabs. There are other algae that can form HABS or nuisance blooms in freshwater or marine habitats. The bottom photo that you see is Spirogyra, which is a filamentous green alga, and you can see that it superficially resembles the HCB that's in the photo at the upper right. So the terms that we use for cyanobacterial accumulations can vary based on the location and the type of accumulation. They can also intergrade, or there might be more than one type present. So blooms are visible accumulations of cyanobacteria in the water column. You can see them as the discolored water that you see in these two photographs. The guidance document focuses on planktonic cyanobacteria, which float in the water and which may be concentrated at the surface, throughout the water column, or at a depth. Planktonic cyanobacteria can form scums, which are accumulations on the surface of the water, typically during a period of calm weather, or floating cyanobacteria may also be concentrated by wind on the downwind shoreline, which you see in these two photos at the right. And finally, what you see in this photograph aren't planktonic cyanobacteria, but there are benthic cyanobacteria that can grow as mats on sediments or surfaces on the bottom of a water body. And these can float to the surface as nuisance accumulations, as you see in this photo. ITRC has benthic HAB guidance, which is linked from the planktonic HCB guidance document. And we're also offering the training for that the benthic guidance document next week. So what are the conditions that promote HCB growth? So previously I covered the different types of HCB accumulations. So what are the factors that promote cyanobacterial growth to HCBs? The specific environmental conditions that promote HCBs can vary by water body and by the cyanobacterial community growing in it. But in general, cyanobacteria grow and accumulate into HCBs with favorable environmental conditions that can include an increase in nutrients. So both phosphorus and nitrogen are needed to fertilize HCB growth to high concentrations of cells. Increases in water temperature play a role, as cyanobacteria are adapted to grow better at warmer water temperatures than other kinds of algae. And finally, hydrological stability, whether that's stratification in a lake, slow flow in a river system, or reduced turbulence, can provide conditions that allow planktonic cyanobacteria to concentrate near the water surface as blooms or scums. We do need to keep in mind that climate change can enhance the environmental factors that promote HCB growth. Warmer temperatures and longer growing seasons create optimal growing conditions and promote the persistence of HCBs from 1 year to the next. Periods of drought enhance the hydrological stability via stratification or by slowing river flow. And finally, a very important factor is that we're seeing intensifying rain events in most of the United States, and heavy rain events can bring nutrients into aquatic systems via runoff. So what is it that makes cyanobacterial blooms harmful? So we consider HCBs to be harmful because some can produce cyanotoxins and other irritants that can cause serious health effects in both people and animals. These compounds include hepatotoxins that affect the liver, neurotoxins that affect the nervous system, and dermatoxins that can affect skin and mucous membranes. Cyanobacteria can also make other types of compounds that can cause general irritation and allergic type reactions. HCBs can also have adverse environmental effects. When large blooms decompose, that can cause low dissolved oxygen. HCBs can also increase the shading that impacts aquatic plant growth. I'm now going to talk a bit about cyanotoxin production and release. Toxin production can really vary over time and space. It's important to remember that not all cyanobacteria can produce toxins, and those that can don't make them all the time. So something we really need to take into account when it comes to monitoring cyanobacteria is that multiple toxin types can be produced by a single species. And in general, toxins are held within intact cyanobacterial cells. So toxins in those cases are considered to be intracellular. There is an exception for the toxin called cylindrospermopsin, which can be released into the surrounding water from actively growing cells. For the other intracellular toxins, those are not released to the water or become extracellular until the cell dies and lyses and the cell wall is broken open. This can happen gradually, such as when a bloom naturally decays, or it can happen suddenly, such as when a chemical treatment is applied to an HCB or if cells are ingested. So how are humans and animals exposed to cyanobacterial blooms and cyanotoxins? Potential exposure can occur near or in a water body containing an HCB. This can happen if you accidentally swallow affected water that contains cyanobacteria and their toxins. You can also be exposed if you breathe in aerosols from water spray or mist, such as by water skiing over a lake containing an HCB, or through direct water contact with skin. Another exposure route is by ingestion of contaminated drinking water or food. Animals can be especially at risk from HCBs and their toxins because they tend to have a higher exposure while drinking and swimming in affected waters. Animals don't avoid contact with water that people would normally not want to touch. Animals can be exposed from ingesting the cyanobacteria that they groom from their fur or feathers, or by intentionally eating scum or mat material that's washed up on shore. Children can also have a higher risk because of their smaller body weight, so it doesn't take ingesting as much cyanotoxin to make them ill as it would for an adult. Children also tend to spend more time in the water and have more hand-to-mouth behavior that can increase their exposure. So given the risks, what regulations and guidance do we have for HCBs and cyanotoxins? Currently, we do not have federal standards for cyanobacteria or cyanotoxins. However, we do have guidance from the US EPA for the toxins microcystin and cylindrospermopsin in both recreational and drinking water. In March 2021, the World Health Organization released recreational guidance for four different toxins: microcystin LR, anatoxin A, cylindrospermopsin, and saxitoxin. Additionally, many states have developed their own regulatory or guidance values for HCBs and cyanotoxins. However, these tend to be focused on planktonic HCBs. Guidelines for benthic cyanobacteria are lacking. So please see the ITRC benthic HCB guidance for more background on this. So please stay tuned for the next modules in this training that will cover guidance and selection tools to help you develop a management plan for HCBs. So next we are going to cover monitoring for cyanobacteria and cyanotoxins. Other modules address communication and response plans, in-lake management and control methods, and nutrient reduction as a strategy to reduce HCB guidance. So next I'm going to be covering monitoring for cyanobacteria. So in this section of our HCB training, we're going to be talking about how to monitor. I will talk about analytical methods that are used to evaluate cyanobacteria and cyanotoxins, and about field collection methods, basically how you fill the bottle that will be delivered to the laboratory. I'll demonstrate the use of the interactive selection tool the team has developed to help you explore which analytical methods may be useful for your water body and your goals. And finally, we'll talk about the elements of a cyanobacteria monitoring program. When we finish this section of today's training, you should have a basic understanding of how to design and conduct a monitoring program to meet your needs. So let's start with how we monitor for cyanobacteria. Monitoring provides the data that you need to describe conditions. For HCBs, that means counts and measures of cyanobacteria and cyanotoxins. They will help you describe what kind of cyanotoxin or cyanobacteria is present, how much is there, when and where it is found. You might also choose to include water quality parameters that describe the conditions that support HCB growth or how HCBs are affected by management strategies you've started in the lake or watershed. And I'll talk a little bit more about this later in the training. So the most important objective when monitoring for HCBs is to support your HCB response plan. A response plan tells you what to do when a bloom is reported and outlines what level of cyanobacteria or cyanotoxin will require you to act, such as closing a beach or posting signs along a recreational path. You will learn about response plans in the next segment of our training today and can read more about it in Section 5 of our guidance document. So as I mentioned before, HCB monitoring can support your HCB management activities. Actions to control cyanobacteria can be focused in the lake itself, such as the application of phosphorus binding chemicals, as you see in the photos here, or be undertaken in the watershed to reduce the source of nutrients that encourage the growth of cyanobacteria. If you decide to include monitoring for management success in your HCB program, you'll want to begin monitoring before the management action starts so that you can characterize the cyanobacteria community before the conditions change. After your management begins, you will continue to monitor using the same methods so you can track how the community responds to your management. So more on this monitoring approach will be discussed in the management and control section later in today's training. So a monitoring plan is all about your needs. It will identify the methods you will use in the field, specifically making sure you get the data you need for those action or alert levels called out in your response plan. because you know how often you'll sample, the cost of the analyses, and the number of people you'll need to do the work, you can set a budget for the program. This is important to keep you from spending all of your funding in June when you know blooms may still occur in August and September. A plan also helps to create and maintain consistency across time. When a bloom occurs, things get hectic really fast. Lots of people are calling for information and lots of people have concerns about their health. Having a plan means you don't need to think long about what's appropriate to collect or where to go. You've already decided that. Having a plan also means you collect the same data in the same way each season, and so you can better compare current data to past experience or track trends over time. So the terms monitoring and sampling are often used interchangeably. However, they do have different meanings. In our guidance, sampling refers to the collection of a single point of data in response to a bloom, as you see this person in the photo filling a bottle from the visible scum. Monitoring is the collection of routine data to detect impending blooms or to track changes over time. Monitoring represents a series of samples, including some that might be collected in response to a bloom situation, but monitoring is mainly visiting the same locations at set intervals, regardless of whether a bloom is present. So let's turn now to the actual methods that are used to measure cyanobacteria. Our guidance document discusses six methods, which are commonly used to decide whether cyanobacteria are present and how much might be there. You can see those methods listed here on the slide. They range from the simple methods that require minimal training and not many tools to those that are more complex and require specific training and often very complex and expensive equipment. Each method is evaluated using the same set of criteria. You can see those criteria listed on the screen here. We discuss in the document, for example, the kind of result that the method provides, cells per milliliter, for example, or micrograms per liter of chlorophyll A. In the document, there's a summary of these criteria for each method so that you can easily compare one method to another. And it's very important that you understand the criteria that we use. We provided a definition of each in their guidance, and you should take a look at that to make sure your interpretation of what the criteria means matches ours. Consider turnaround time, for example. We define turnaround time as the time needed to prepare the sample, run the analysis, and get the raw data. If you are sending a team into the field to collect a sample, that time is not included in our definition. To fully estimate how much time it will take before you have data to share, you need to add the field time to the turnaround time. If your sample location is located far from your laboratory, there are very few methods that will get late data to you in less than one day. There is one very important thing to remember about cyanobacteria methods. They do not provide any information about cyanobacterial toxins. It is not possible to use any of these methods to tell what kind of cyanotoxins may be present. You must use a method designed specifically to test for cyanotoxins. So let's turn now to look at those methods that test for cyanotoxins. Our guidance covers six methods commonly used for evaluating cyanotoxins listed here. Like the cyanobacteria methods, they range from those that are simple and require minimal tools to those that require specialized training and equipment. Similar to the cyanobacteria, we use a single set of criteria to evaluate each method and summarize them in a table associated with each method so you can easily compare them. And there are some key things to remember about cyanotoxin analytical methods. No single method can provide information about all possible toxins. You cannot fill one bottle, run it on one machine one time, and learn all about cyanotoxins. If you want to know about anatoxin A, microcystis, or cylinder spermopsin, you will need to run three separate analyses and account for this in your monitoring plan. Guidance values may not be available for all cyanotoxins. Guidance values help you to understand the meaning of your toxin result. 4.5 micrograms per liter of microcystin is just a number without that guidance telling you how to interpret and use it. There are federal guidance values for several cyanotoxins, and some states have also developed their own. As you build your monitoring plan, it's important to know what guidance values are applicable to your water body. Another thing to remember is that there might be interference from compounds, environmental or otherwise, when analyzing your samples. It's important to understand your method and possible interferences so that you can use the proper bottles, proper preservation, or otherwise minimize their effect on your analysis. Your samples might require specific preparation or extraction. This is especially important for plant and animal tissues. They require very different preparation from water samples. These preparation methods are continually changing and improving, so it's important to review available methods and use the best sample preparation for your goals. And finally, it's also important to remember that cyanotoxin results tell you only about conditions at the time you filled your bottle. They can't tell you about what happened 2 days ago or predict what will happen in 2 days or even 2 hours into the future. They're a snapshot of one point in time and need to be used with that in mind. So let's talk now about sample collection methods, how you fill the bottle that would be analyzed at the laboratory. We created a flowchart to help you decide which field methods to use. You see a part of it here. The full flowchart is in the guidance document. You select the water body type, still water versus flowing, for example, possible locations to sample, and then you can see which methods may be appropriate. The location of the HCB is important in deciding which field sampling approach to use. We've developed a graphic to remind you of possible locations for HCBs, and you'll find it in our guidance document. If you're looking at a floating HCB, you will use methods for plankton. If the HCB is located on the bottom, attached to plants, or washed up on the shoreline, you will use benthic approaches. If you are interested in cyanotoxins that may be in the water, extracellular toxins, you'll use another set of methods. So the HCB1 guidance document is focused primarily on planktonic or floating HCBs, but we do have the HCB2 document with information about benthic HCBs. So the training, again, focused on HCB2 will occur next week. So let's talk now about how to build a monitoring plan for your water body. A monitoring plan is a story of what you are going to do. It tells everyone why you are sampling, when, where, and how you'll sample, as well as who will do the work. A monitoring plan for large fill reservoir, the fictional lake, which is shown here on the slide, would consider a monitoring plan to meet the needs of all of the stakeholders on the lake, federal, state, and county facilities, the two drinking water facilities, as well as the boating, swimming, and fishing public. As you consider developing a monitoring plan for a location like Largeville Reservoir, you will want to consider the sustainability in the long term. Your budget needs to include sufficient resources to cover staff and analytical costs, any training needs, and any quality control requirements. As I mentioned before, for a large water body that's subject to frequent blooms, monitoring costs can be high if you try to do everything. It's important to find that sustainable balance between getting all the information you want and the basic information that you need. Partnerships with stakeholders around the water body can help with the sustainability. If you consider hypothetical Largeville Reservoir, there are several stakeholders who could assist with your monitoring. Beach and boat launch managers can report on daily cyanobacterial conditions. Drinking water facilities may be able to cover the cost of some cyanotoxin analyses, and there may be other options as well. And don't forget to consider whether there are additional environmental conditions that you'd like to track along with cyanobacteria. Adding something as basic as water clarity measurements, as shown here on the slide, to your monitoring visits adds only a little time and the cost of a Secchi disc. It's a simple measure that may allow you to evaluate both cyanobacteria presence and the effectiveness of your best management practices. So now I'd like to demonstrate the use of our monitoring tool to evaluate which analytical methods might be appropriate for your lake. We'll use large field reservoir as an example of how you might build a monitoring program. There have been no previous bloom reports on this water body, so there's no monitoring program in place currently. However, a dog illness has been reported from the county boat ramp. The state investigated the area and confirmed the presence of both cyanobacteria and cyanotoxins. They recommend that a monitoring program be developed for the reservoir. Because this is the first bloom reported from Largeville Reservoir, they don't have a cyanobacteria response plan to follow. However, they have some basic information that they would like their monitoring program to provide. They would like to be able to learn quickly about cyanobacteria conditions so they can communicate rapidly with the public. They would also like to monitor in such a way to get a heads up when conditions may indicate a bloom is forming. And finally, they want to make sure that their monitoring provides information for the drinking water facilities, the recreational activities on the reservoir, and to keep pets safe. So this slide shows how the monitoring tool appears on our webpage. It includes all the criteria that we use to evaluate each method. Three of these criteria allow you to whittle down the list of 12 methods to those that are of most interest. For example, if we want to find those that are the fastest, we wouldn't check the box, which indicates a lab is required. And we would also uncheck the box for a turnaround time of 1 to 3 days. That will get us to the quickest methods for cyanobacteria and cyanotoxins. So when you make that selection, this list of cyanobacteria methods appears. Note that I can't include the cyanotoxin methods on the slide because of space. The list of methods appears on the left side of the table. All the methods are hyperlinked directly to the guidance document so that you can easily read about them. The first six columns are color-coded, as you see here. Green indicates the method is appropriate for the criterion. Red indicates that it's not. So let's look at those first three criteria under cyanobacteria right here. The first, PA, refers to the ability of the method to tell you whether the cyanobacteria are present or absent. The next criteria, ID, refers to the ability of the method to identify to the genus level, so whether you have Microcystis or Dolichospermum, for example. All the circles here are red, indicating that these methods can't do that. The third criteria, DEN, refers to the ability of the method to evaluate the density of cyanobacteria, and then you can see that two of the methods can be used for this, while the other two cannot. All three of the cyanotoxin criteria have red circles, reinforcing what I said earlier, that cyanobacteria methods cannot tell you whether cyanotoxins are present. You can also use the monitoring tool to quickly compare all the methods to one another. If, for example, you are looking at for methods that are lower in cost, you would read about those methods indicated by $1 to $2 signs, as you see in the relative cost column. For those that can be done by just about anyone, you'd look at those identified as having a level of training at novice or intermediate, as you see here in the rightmost column. And again, all of those methods are hyperlinked directly to the text for that method in the document, so you can quickly and easily compare them to one another. So let's wrap up the discussion on monitoring by reviewing the key things that I'd like you to remember when you're building a monitoring plan. First, be sure to identify your goals and choose those analytical methods that get you the data you need. If your guidance says beaches will be closed when cell counts exceed 100,000 per milliliter, using a visual assessment will not get the information you need to close a beach. Use our monitoring selection tool to evaluate methods and find those that can meet your needs. Build your monitoring plan to tell the full story and make sure it includes the who, what, why, when, and where, and to make a plan that meets your needs. Your needs should be outlined by your response plan and should also be included in an HCB management plan. And finally, consider how to make your plan sustainable in the long run so you can compare current and past conditions. So now I'm going to turn it over to Devin so we can get to our first questions.
All right. Thank you so much, Gina. So like she said, we're going to jump right into our first Q&A break, and then we will have one at the end as well. So I'm going to look to our Q&A pod here, and I'm going to read the questions that we have already in there. Would you please share the quick field tip for checking to see if a bloom is cyanobacteria or green algae, also known as the stick test?
I can take that. The jar and the stick test can be used to tell if you have a planktonic bloom just by if you've got green water, or if you've got some green water and you want to know if it's a planktonic cyanobacteria or something else. You can put that water in a jar, shake it up, let it sit for a while, and eventually planktonic cyanobacteria, because they're buoyant, will float to the surface and form a floating scum within that jar that you can see. You do have to look at it closely because there are other things like duckweed and watermeal, which are small aquatic plants that can also form floating layers. True algae, if they're responsible for the green coloration in the water, tend to sink to the bottom of the water, but the jar test isn't truly foolproof. If you want to know exactly what's in that water, you do need to look at it with a microscope to tell for sure what's in it. If you've got floating green scums, you can use what's called a stick test. You basically take a stick, put it under that mat of stuff in the water, and pull it out. If what you see hanging off that, if what you have collected with the stick looks like green hair that's hanging off that stick, it's probably going to be filamentous green algae, such as Spirogyra or its relatives. If that stick goes right through that mat and comes out looking like it's covered in paint, that's probably going to be a cyanobacteria mat. I do have to add that there is sort of there's one outlier for the stick test. There is a cyanobacterium called Microcyra wallii, formerly known as Lingbia wallii, that can grow as very long filaments for a cyanobacterium, several centimeters long. So if you have mats of that, you put a stick in the mats of that and pull it out of the water, it will look like hair hanging off that stick. However, it tends to be very, very dark green to almost blackish in color. So color is important too, in addition to the texture.
All right, thank you, Gina. Next question. Have there been any studies or guidance on what environmental conditions lead to different toxin synthesis?
I can try to get an answer, stab at answering this one. It's complex. We don't quite fully understand why certain species produce toxins, and the rationale as to why certain conditions that we observe are toxin forming and versus non-toxin forming is still a matter of scientific debate within the community. We do understand that there's a role that nutrients seem to be driving, as well as other factors like temperature and water conditions that seem to be really driving some of the toxins that we are finding in various locations. But as far as when we always observe X, we always see microcystin, anatoxin, saxitoxin, so on and so forth. The science is not very clear on that yet.
All right. Thank you so much, Rob. So that was the last question that we had in the Q&A pod here. So just to, be conscious of time, we're going to move on to the next section. We will have another I just got one, so I might as well read it now that we have a moment here, but then we'll move on and we will have another Q&A at the end. So last question, is there any recommended applications for composite samples?
I can tackle that. If you're talking about making composite samples, for example, for beach monitoring, the state of Ohio has really great a really great method where you basically take 9 separate samples. You have 3 transects, and on each of those transects, you collect water at 3 different depths, composite it all in one large container, and then take your sample out of that big container for analysis. So that can kind of give you an overview of the relative risk of all of the water at the beach at that point in time versus just a single point. And this is important because blooms can be really patchy in time and space. And you could have conditions in which you've got really patchy blooms. And if you're only sampling at a clear area versus where that bloom is, that could really skew your results. So check out, I think it's Ohio EPA's beach guidance. I'll try to get Devin to put that link in the chat later.
All right. Thank you, Gina. So last question, and then we'll move on. Does roadway salt affect cyanobacteria growth?
I think there's some general evidence to show that the increase of salinity has an impact in not just cyanobacteria, but all photosynthetic and all microbial life. There's not been anything that I've seen. Maybe someone else, either Gina or Hannah, might have seen something that's specifically towards cyanobacteria, but they're, the increase of salinity is impacting microbial life.
Yeah, I would just follow up with that. A lot of cyanobacteria species do thrive in disturbance. And so introduction of salt or other compounds that are pollutants to the water can create a space for more salt-tolerant cyanobacteria to move in.
All right. Thank you, Hannah and Rob. So with that, we are going to move to our next section, which is communication and bloom response planning. And Hannah is going to deliver that section for us here. So Hannah, when you're ready.
Yeah. Thank you, Devin. Good afternoon, everyone. Like Devin said, I'm going to be chatting to you today about forming a HCB risk communication plan, both short-term and long-term. And so the main points I want to hit on with this discussion is, first of all, just going over the basics of risk communication and then talking about what this kind of response can look on two different timescales. So to start with, let's just talk a little bit about what risk communication is. It's a science-based approach for communicating effectively in situations that might be high risk, unfamiliar, or controversial. And good risk communication leads the public to being able to make informed decisions. And like all effective forms of communication, you do that by customizing your messages to meet the needs of different audience members. Effective risk communication also helps you build good relationships with your audiences, and that relationship is based on these shared goals, values, and problem solving. I'm going to talk about a few best practices that go into forming this kind of relationship, and then we'll dive a little bit more into specifics. So the first thing is, when you're risk communicating, you want to understand your audience, what they know about the risk, and you want them to make sure that you're communicating in a way that meets that background knowledge and understanding. As well, you want to use emotion in communication and make sure you can communicate with empathy and with understanding. And as well, the ultimate goal here is to build trust and credibility, which happens through conveying accurate information, transparency, and keeping the public informed as the situation develops. A really great tool in risk communication is coming up with short, concise messages that focus the public and who you're communicating to on the most important information. This is called message mapping, and it allows the public, especially when they're under stress, to be able to have quick, clear information about health risk, health advisories, and water-related activities that could threaten them or their pet's health. When you're coming up with your plan, you want to develop these key messages and then coordinate with your other credible sources and partners to have consistent messaging, and also work closely with the media. They can be huge advocates in getting out good message, and they'll be able to help you out if you can provide clear information to them in a timely manner. With all these best practices, preparation before a HCB occurs is really key to make sure you're prepared and you have a plan in place. As well, evaluating how communication has went in the past or how your plan has been playing out is also really important, because this is an iterative process where you can continue to improve and make sure your communication is occurring effectively. I'm going to touch on a few points, especially on this short-term communication, but as with our other sections, there's a lot of great resources and much more in-depth information on the ITRC Risk Communication Toolkit Section 4. So let's talk about these two types of planning. There's, first of all, this immediate communication and monitoring response plan that occurs during an active harmful cyanobacteria bloom. And then there's more long-term response planning, which is something that you do during the off-season to be prepared for coming HCB events. The immediate HCP response plan consists of 5 key elements, which I've listed here. The first is reporting, notification, and coordination, then bloom confirmation, drinking water source identification and response, if necessary, the issuance of health advisories, and then finally reporting on HCP-related illnesses. We're going to take a few minutes to walk through each of these points. First is HCP reporting, notification, and coordination. And as I mentioned, it's important to establish these methods beforehand so you can respond quickly and efficiently when a bloom occurs. You're going to want to develop a reporting mechanism that can be used by partner agencies, stakeholders, and members of the public, and make sure that all bloom reports you receive are going to a centralized location. You'll also want to set up a system that allows you to notify other partner organizations, things like health departments, state parks, or lake managers, right away to let them know when you receive a report of a bloom. Once you've received a report, you'll be working with these partners to coordinate a response, and then also working with them to notify the public when you receive a report and confirm the presence of an HCP. Second step is after you receive a bloom report, you then can use things such as visual observations to help determine if, in fact, the reported bloom is cyanobacteria. You could also use other tools here like remote sensing, and then, of course, going into the monitoring techniques that Gina just talked to us about to figure out if a bloom is present and the severity. Throughout this process, again, you want to be communicating clearly to the public what you're finding and your plan for learning more. And then, of course, that brings to communication. This is the emphasis here. Once you've visited a site and have confirmation of a bloom, you need to let the public and media know using these same best practices covered previously. Once again, it's really important to be transparent here about what you know and what you don't, and to let the public know where they can go for additional information. For example, you might have a designated location where these updates are posted. This could be a dedicated website. It could be call-in line with a pre-recorded message. It could be through your social media channels. And on all these sites and sources, you want also a mechanism for continued reports of blooms or potential HCP illnesses to be reported. For many organizations, this could be something like a local poison control center or a health agency. As well, an important part of this communication plan is making sure that drinking water sources that could be affected by the bloom are notified right away. Under the best case scenario, if a drinking water source is affected, it may already have a cyanotoxin management plan in place. However, if that's not the case, the HCP guidance document we're talking about today also contains resources to help water systems prepare one. If a public water system doesn't have a plan in place, you can also assist them by doing something like providing sampling data or collecting samples near plant intakes or outflows. Treatment plants may consider alternative water sources until a bloom subsides. And again, in addition to drinking water, we want to make sure we're communicating to the public so that even if they receive or if they arrive at the water body and are concerned about recreation, they have that information available to them. Gina mentioned it, but consistent signage is a key component of this and in helping the public understand what sort of recreation may or may not be appropriate. Some best practices when it comes to designing signage is, first of all, using different colors that communicate a sense of warning. Orange, yellow, and red is great for this. Considering using icons so signs are quick and easy to digest. For the text you may have on signs, using plain and simple language. And considering including more than one language so that your sign's message may be able to reach diverse populations. Signs may also include information on the impacts of HCBs to dogs. And you also might want to consider at a water body whether temporary signs versus permanent signs make the most sense. For water bodies that only experience sporadic HCBs, temporary signs just put up at the time of occurrence might make the most sense. Versus for water bodies that experience persistent HCBs, more permanent signage may work better. And then, of course, oftentimes signs are used to communicate health advisories. Gina already touched a little bit on this, but these advisories should be determined beforehand with a clear sense of what will trigger the issuance of an advisory. Many states or organizations use either visual or cell count concentrations of cyanobacteria or different cyanotoxin levels. You also want to think about beforehand the mechanism for issuing the advisory. what organization will have the authority to do that, and when will they do it? You may consider creating a flowchart like the one that's shown here that walks through this process, includes these values, and explains who's responsible both for posting and listing an advisory. And as I've already said multiple times, communicating these advisories through a variety of media, whether that be signs, press release, websites, social media, or all of the above, are really good ways to get the word out. And then finally, throughout a bloom, you want to be getting feedback on how your communication is working and the effects the bloom may be having on human health. The public should be provided with information about the health risk possible and be able to have a good resource to get information if they do experience potentially HCV-related illness. Again, this could be through a local health department, a local poison control center, and this information should be posted and included on all these forms of communication you're putting out there. So let's talk about how this would look in our hypothetical scenario if, say, Largeville Reservoir experiences a bloom. In this scenario, we became aware of a bloom when our agency receives a call from a vet on our 24-hour HCV report line. The vet tells you that the dog was playing around the boat ramp before falling ill with symptoms that could be caused by cyanotoxin poisoning. The duty officer who receives the call notifies agency staff and partner agencies right away, and a state park employee volunteers to sample the area the next day. You notify the public that there's a possible HCB on your social media channels and promise updates as soon as you know more. Step two, bloom confirmation. Those samples are collected, and beforehand, you decide that you want to sample specifically for cyanotoxins because of the dog's illness. The state park staff collects the samples and delivers them to the lab before it closes, and the lab runs the samples and actually finds high levels of cyanotoxins are present. Once again, you want to take this information right away and immediately use all your media channels to let the public know what you've found and how people can protect themselves and their pets as you continue to learn more. Sharing this information quickly helps the public stay calm, and you again promise to share more information as you continue to learn more about the situation. And all this messaging also includes information with local poison control center phone numbers so people can report any illness. As you continue to investigate and monitor, you also plan to organize a town hall to answer questions and continue to keep the public updated. Step three, our drinking water response. Right away, drinking water staff of your agency also go ahead and contact the Largeville drinking water plant, sharing this information about the bloom. Unfortunately, in this scenario, the utility doesn't have a cyanotoxin response plan, so you offer to also collect samples at the plant intake and outflow. In the meantime, while you wait for more information, the plant closes their water intake from the reservoir and uses an alternate source until more is learned. And once again, this is communicated to the public to assure that their drinking water is safe. Step four, the local health department, once they receive the lab results on cyanotoxin levels, decides to issue a health advisory. They end up closing the area of the reservoir near the boat ramp and post a lot of signs so people can quickly see what's going on and be able to appropriately make behavior about their recreation. You also pass on this information through a press release and on social media. And then finally, illness reporting. Because information about the Poison Control Center has been included on these communication materials, you actually hear from several families who recreated near the boat ramp and experienced vomiting and diarrhea a few days after. They're able to call the Poison Center, report their symptoms, and receive medical advice. And this information is also reported back to you to be able to protect future recreators and be able to follow up with them. And throughout all five of these steps, you're using this concept of message mapping with your three critical messages about where this harmful cyanobacteria bloom is, what the health department is doing, and what this means for public action and health. So that was a quick scenario about what this immediate response might look like. And as I mentioned, this immediate response is also complemented by a longer-term bloom response plan. Longer-term response is something that's developed before these immediate actions happen, but are in fact key to making them work out well. Long-term plans includes things like coming up with a routine, sampling and monitoring plan, and working with things like drinking water suppliers to have an emergency response in place, having already communication and outreach collaboration partners, having a place for your data to go, and then being able to evaluate how well HCB reported illnesses reporting and communication is going. And as I mentioned earlier, developing this is an iterative process that you repeat over and over as you continue to refine these plans. There's also more information about this long-term bloom response planning on section 5.2 of the HCB guidance document. So to wrap everything up with some key takeaways, risk communication is a really critical part of an effective bloom response. As we discussed at the beginning of the training, risk communication provides the public with the information they want and they need so they can make informed decisions during an HCB. Planning is, of course, an integral part of this risk communication, and it's important to develop both immediate and long-term plans to address HCBs. And then finally, clear messaging and timely communication about HCBs is necessary to build the trust and credibility you want with the public to be able to protect their health and make sure this communication remains ongoing and transparent. And with that, I'm going to turn the time over to Rob for our next section.
Hey, Rob, you're still on mute if you're talking.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can.
Okay, sorry about that. For whatever reason,
no worries. Froze.
Okay, all right. Sorry about the little technical difficulties. All right, so welcome to Chapter 6 of the Guidance Document. In the previous modules, you learned about the identification, response, and communication. In the next module, you'll learn about watershed-level approaches. In this section, this section is focusing on managing and controlling blooms in lakes and other water bodies. So, help, we have a bloom. So naturally, we hope that lake managers and stakeholders will explore the resource before they're confronted with the crisis of a bloom. However, we recognize that people might arrive needing help. This section of the document is designed with that in mind. Our goal is to provide an organized and cohesive framework to learn about the different strategies and evaluate their suitability for use in any given situation. The web portal allows users to browse online and download documents directly from Section 6 and the strategy fact sheets in Appendix C. It also allows users to explore options interactively using the online selection tool. Let's take a tour. So let's dive right into the guidance document. Section 6 is fairly short, but it is important. It provides an overview of considerations that apply broadly to all in-lake control and treatment strategies. It includes a review of some of the factors that you'll want to account for before selecting an approach. And you'll also find a summary table listing the 24 strategies that were researched in depth by the team. You'll notice that entries in this table are hot linked. Those links in the table lead directly to Appendix C, which contains over 70 pages of detailed content. There is a downloadable fact sheet for each of the 24 strategies. There is also a cost comparison table and a short summary of about half of a dozen additional strategies that are not covered in depth individually. The modular structure makes it easy for resource managers to focus on only strategies that are suitable for their situation. So how do we decide what strategies to include with the fact sheet? First, we focused only on surface water and excluded treatment methods that were used primarily in drinking or wastewater utilities. Engineered water systems have a different set of considerations and a robust body of supporting research and literature. We also limited research to freshwater water bodies rather than marine systems. Most importantly, though, the strategies included are those that have been evaluated in peer-reviewed mainstream scientific literature or in government agency white papers. There are a number of methods, both old and new, that at the time have primary anecdotal evidence or are supported only from vendors and not yet from independent evaluators. these methods were not included. A quick note. Although the fact sheets and online selection tool were originally focused on planktonic blooms, both have been updated to include the benthic blooms, which will be presented next week. Let's take a look at a fact sheet. Each one is designed to stand alone, but they have a common structure to facilitate comparison. This one is for hypolimnic oxygen and aeration. The header shows the type of strategy, as well as the strength of support for its use in both planktonic and benthic blooms. A strategy is considered an intervention if it's meant to be used on an active bloom, whereas a prevention is used to reduce the likelihood or intensity of future blooms. Supporting data is considered to be substantial if evidence of its effectiveness is clear and robust. For a strategy that has not yet been studied as thoroughly or has some mixed results, it might be included as limited. Meanwhile, a relatively new method that has mostly laboratory or rather field supported might be scored as emerging. Note that because there have been less research on strategies for benthic blooms, some may be characterized as unknown type with no supporting data for benthics. The fact sheets start with a general technical description, which may be illustrated with photos or diagrams. There is a checklist to summarize the conditions where treatment has been demonstrated most effective and the type of bloom for which it's best situated for. Later in the fact sheet, you'll find a summary of advantages and limitations. This is followed by a brief cost analysis, at least one case study, and notes about regulatory and policy considerations. The literature reference for each fact sheet is also included to make further research easy for the user. If there were one perfect, affordable method for control of every bloom, every lake manager would be using it. So there is no silver bullet for controlling and preventing blooms. Instead, we know that HCBs, like all other problems that are both complex and persistent, attracts many attempts at treatments to end solutions. To use a medical analogy, the water body is not well, and HCBs are a manifestation of a sickness. We have a landscape of treatment options, old and new, short-term or long-term, more or less invasive, or more or less costly. But different treatments are better suited for different cases. The more you know about the situation, the better your odds at making a good choice. This resource does not give prescriptions, but instead serves as a compendium aimed at providing users with a systemic overview of strategies that have support in current peer-reviewed literature. It is not intended to promote one strategy over another, but to support informed decision-making, to help you consider the context, understand the constraints, weigh the pros and cons, and set realistic expectations for outcomes. So, is choosing a strategy as easy as choosing a fact sheet that looks good? Of course it's not. We want to make an informed decision by sorting through options in a logical way. We can group strategies according to a variety of factors. What are the top-level considerations? First, each strategy can be categorized as prevention, an intervention, or both. Next, what type of water body is affected? Is it a pond, typically with a depth of 10 feet or less, a lake or a reservoir, which is a larger water body with a residence time that may exceed over a year, a river? Finally, are you concerned primarily with a planktonic or benthic vent? As you'll see in a moment, these are factors that serve as primary filtering criteria in the interactive management criteria selection tool on the web portal. If we are serious about identifying a strategy for a real-world situation, we will want to collect some additional information. First, we want to learn about our water body. Characteristics like surface area and depth, residence time, mixing regime, natural turbidity, and chemistry will affect all the choices for the type of control strategy that we use. Also, if a lake is highly enriched eutrophic, it is important to know whether the input is from internal loading or ongoing from the watershed. Are there use-related factors that might limit choices? For example, is this a drinking water storage reservoir? Are there swimming beaches? Is management limited by the presence of protected species, important game species, or is an invasive species present? If your water body has seasonal or other special influences to consider, for example, ice coverage or regular water level changes, make note of those too. And of course, we want to know as much as possible as we can about the bloom. Is it a new problem, or is there a history of frequent occurrences of the bloom? When it does occur, is there an element of seasonal predictability? What about the location and scale? Does it tend to start and accumulate in one area? How bad is it? Is it mild or is it intense? Do you know what the species are that's most abundant and whether cytotoxins have been detected at all? Finally, there are always practical and human considerations. How important is bloom control relative to other management and use priorities? Are there littoral zones important for fish spawning? Is it more important to have swimmable beaches in July or safe drinking water year-round? Are there other management actions in place that could present conflicting goals? What are the logical constraints, the immediate budget, the ongoing budget, and the available infrastructure and staffing? It's important to consider whether there are regulations that constrain options. For example, placing structures on the lake bed or applying algicides. This varies from state to state and sometimes at a local or water body level. It's also important to consider stakeholder perspectives and the overall risk tolerance of managers and community, including downstream neighbors, which is a major consideration for both rivers and reservoirs. With all this information assembled, we are ready to explore our options. As we know, the web portal offers Section 6 and Appendix C for online browsing or download. In addition, there is a management criteria selection tool which allows users to explore options interactively. Let's use it to explore a scenario on Smallberg Lake. What do we know about the situation at Smallberg Lake? This is a shallow, well-mixed 50-acre lake with unregulated outflow. It has nutrient loading from septic systems, resident waterfowl, and probably from row crops in the watershed. It is loosely managed by the county. There's a county park and a scout camp on the north side and private shoreline on the south. Residents know that it gets green during most dry summers, but there has been no real concern in the past. However, a visiting colleague from Largeville Reservoirs recognizes the green as a HCB, tested the bloom, and found toxins, which puts an immediate stop to recreational use. The county is starting from scratch. They've never thought about HCB management before. They are interested in both intervention, because there's an ongoing bloom, and prevention for the planktonic bloom. We note that this is a small recreational lake that's well mixed with a long residence time. What else do we know? It's eutrophic, probably with some regular external nutrient loading. Managers are open-minded about options. They're willing to explore methods with limited or emerging field support, as well as substantial research evidence to support them. Rather than reading over 70 pages of fact sheets, they start with the interactive tool on the web portal to explore the 24 strategies and apply the factors that we just discussed. Because they are using such broad selection criteria for a common water body site, only one option is eliminated as a candidate. However, using the additional sorting factors in the output table, they're able to eliminate five more strategies, two that are not recommended for turbid lakes, which is acidification and UV exposure, and three that are not relevant for shallow lakes, which is artificial mixing, hypolignitic oxygenation, and hypolignitic withdrawal. This diagram shows the other 18 candidates that remain after the filtering criteria has been applied. It includes a range of strategies that have emerging, limited, and substantial supporting data. But in theory, they all might be possibilities for use in a relatively small, shallow system like Smallberg Lake. Five strategies are characterized as prevention, only four as intervention, and nine may be considered for both prevention and intervention, which is the overlap of the Venn diagram. The next step is to investigate them further. The stakeholders want the lake's problem to be fixed as soon as possible. So the county convenes a community meeting with speakers from Largeville University Environmental Sciences Department, the County Extension Office, and the lake managers from nearby Largeville Reservoir. The speakers remind everybody that there is no universal prescription, so they need to discuss options. Now let's walk through these options with the stakeholder community. First, they eliminate monitored natural attenuation. They want something done now before the 4th of July. Next, two physical methods are rejected, dredging for being too invasive and expensive, and hydraulic flushing because it's not compatible with the dam outflow structure. Dye shading is rejected because it would change the lake's appearance. And after more research and discussion, several other methods are also rejected for being too untested, too unavailable, or too expensive. And these include food web and microbial biomanipulation, nanoparticles, ozonation, organic biocides, and skimming and harvesting. Finally, the university expert cautions that phosphorus binding compounds and flocculation may not be the best solutions, since the lake continues to have nutrient input from the watershed, so those are set aside as well. The universe of options has been constrained through careful consideration. Fortunately, there are some viable options to work with. Some are well-tested, some have limited support, but the stakeholders are willing to consider all of them. They check with the State Department of Environmental Quality to see whether there are any regulatory constraints. They learn that all remaining strategies are allowable, though there are some regulations that may apply and permits may be necessary. The county decides to apply peroxide algicide lakewide. If this doesn't work, they will have another meeting to consider a one-time use of copper algicide. The next summer, the emphasis will be on prevention. The county staff, with volunteer help from scouts, will install barley straw in the north part of the lake next spring. With some help from the golf course, the homeowners association is buying an ultrasound device for their corner of the lake, and they'll research floating wetland islands as well. So let's review. The stakeholder and management group has decided to adopt a variety of approaches. The county does not want to treat the lake year after year, but they will hire a lake management company to knock down this year's bloom with algicide, first with peroxide, and then with chelated copper as a backup. During and after the algicide application, no recreational use will be permitted, and cyanotoxins will be monitored until they fall below levels of concern. Over the coming months, the county will work to acquire barley straw to install on the north shoreline next spring. Meanwhile, the Homeowners Association and the golf course will buy an ultrasound device and research floating wetland islands. As you may already have guessed, the county government has wisely recognized that this is an opportunity to strengthen communication and monitoring. They're convening a stakeholdering group that includes both lake and watershed interest, and they have agreed to pay for lake-wide toxin testing. Work with Largeville University scientists to track the results and update the community throughout both traditional and social media. Before implementing a strategy, let's go back to Section 6 of the document to make sure we're not forgetting anything. Yes, the county has done these things. As part of the chosen strategy, they've researched permit requirements and checked in with stakeholders. They have considered the possible side effects and deemed them acceptable given the uses of the lake. They have gotten estimates from several different lake management companies and have reviewed short and long-term budget impacts as well as the logistics. And finally, they're working with the community to communicate their goals and their plans. Perhaps most importantly, the county now knows that in order to evaluate different strategies, it's important to monitor both before and after implementation in both treated and control areas if possible. For Smallberg Lake, they are trying one strategy in the North Cove and one in the South. They plan to monitor conditions in both locations as well as at the dam where no treatment is being applied. With help from experts and students at Largeville University, they will collect samples for cyanotoxins and cell counts on a weekly basis. And after the treatments, along with dissolved oxygen and nutrients, the county has asked State Wildlife Agency and State Regulatory Agency to review their plans. Both agencies agree that it's important to measure dissolved oxygen and toxins when they're applying any algicide. They like the monitoring plan, and they note that the lake management contractor that has been selected is well-established and familiar with the permitting process. As we've seen with the Smallberg Lake example, adaptive management will increase your odds of understanding and success. HCBs are complex phenomena, and no two are exactly the same. So it's important to set realistic expectations, make methodical, careful decisions based on as much data as possible, but remain flexible and learn from every attempt, whether it is successful or not. This is how adaptive management works. That first toxic bloom can induce panic. So it may require conscious effort to take a step back and look at the big picture, to consider the fiscal, practical, and ecological consequences of any approach. Use the event as an opportunity to recruit allies and communicate with stakeholders. If the intervention strategies are planned, determine in advance what cue will trigger an intervention. And of course, throughout any implementation of any strategy, include a monitoring plan that will close the loop and allow you to assess the effectiveness of your management and control efforts. One final note. The fact sheets presented in Appendix C do not include everything on the market today, and certainly not everything that will be on the market tomorrow. Complex, persistent problems continue to inspire many attempts to solve them, and new options are emerging constantly. When you encounter a new option, evaluate it systemically by asking the same questions. Are peer-reviewed, independent field studies available? Does evidence match the claims? Does it fit your particular water body and your management goals? What are the upfront and recurring costs? How often does the treatment need to be applied and to what extent? What are the possible short and long-term impacts to the water body? Is it reversible or will it leave a lasting impact? Are there possible side effects or residuals? These are all really important questions that you have to ask. So what are our key takeaways? As we've seen, the options can seem overwhelming, but you can improve your odds of success by learning as much as you possibly can about your water body and the bloom. Then set real goals realistically relative to the water body's uses and fiscal and other constraints. Consider whether a proposed strategy treats the symptom or addresses the underlying causes. Include a well-designed monitoring plan with your treatment so that you can evaluate how effective it is. You can use the management and control section of the ITRC guidance document to help you work through all these steps and considerations. And most importantly, understand that in-lake management strategies are just one part of a bigger picture that includes understanding and monitoring of HCBs, which includes response and communication and watershed management. And with that mention of watershed management, I'd like to welcome back Hannah.
Awesome. Thank you, Rob. So for this final module, we're going to be talking about strategies for reducing nutrients in the watershed. And this is all covered in Section 7 of the guidance document we're talking about today. Let's make sure I can press these. Perfect. So first of all, just to provide some initial context, in this section of the training, I want to go over four different categories of nutrient management. So first of all, reviewing the factors and how they influence HCBs, talking about steps for success, going over some of the tools in the HCB water web portal, and then we'll go through a final scenario application. So as many of you, we already talked about earlier in the introductory training module, there are a number of known variables that contribute to HCBs, and also a lot of unknowns that can influence the extent, the magnitude, or the duration of these blooms. Key to these factors are nutrients, light availability, and temperature, and the timing of these three as they influence the growth of planktonic HCBs. However, as you can imagine, of these three variables, nutrients are the contributor that we can have some hope to control. We can't change necessarily light availability or temperature of a broad scale environment. Thus, nutrients is something we focus on when we try to prevent blooms from occurring in the first place. And, you know, even nutrients, though, are complex, with the most prominent source of nutrients varying quite a bit by location. And really requiring us as water body managers to understand wide-scale land use throughout the watershed. As well, even if we can understand where nutrients are coming from, removing them from our waterways is challenging. They're pervasive and already found naturally throughout a watershed. And as well, they can be persistent. Even if you stop putting nutrients into a water body, you might already have a significant accumulation. As well, nutrients inherently are not bad. They're necessary for growth and ecologic function. So figuring out what the optimal amount is for your watershed is another question and something to consider. However, for this training and guidance, we do want to place emphasis on reducing and controlling nutrients in a watershed to prevent HCBs. And we're going to focus specifically on voluntary approaches for doing this. I will note and mention a few times, however, that there also are regulatory aspects when it comes to controlling nutrients from point sources in many states that can also be employed when needed. So let's first of all talk about how human activities can increase the levels of nutrients, phosphorus and nitrogen specifically, in our water bodies. So to begin with, these nutrients, as I mentioned, are naturally occurring, and they also are typically the elements that limit growth in terrestrial and especially aquatic ecosystems where these HCBs are occurring. So as you're adding more nutrients to a system or to a water body, more growth can occur. Human activities can increase these nutrients in a few different ways. First of all, talking about phosphorus. Aside from point source effluent discharges, phosphorus is generally either related to sediment erosion and transport within your watershed, or it can also come from human sources, things such as waste disposal, runoff from animals or humans. It can be applied directly as a concentrated fertilizer as part of crop growth. And phosphorus can also be used industrially in detergents or for production of materials. In terms of nitrogen, nitrogen is actually most commonly found in more of a gaseous form. And so because of that, its cycling in the natural environment is more complicated than phosphorus. And oftentimes, limiting nitrogen is more complicated than limiting phosphorus. If you recall from the introductory module, some cyanobacteria also have the ability to fix nitrogen from the atmosphere and bring it into the aquatic environment, which adds this extra level of complexity. Nonetheless, when it comes to human sources of nitrogen, it shares a lot of the same sources that phosphorus has. I also should add here that for this training and for our guidance, we're not going to wade into the debate, which is ongoing, on whether reducing nitrogen versus phosphorus is more important for preventing HCBs. We know that both are critical for growth. And so it really just depends on the ecology of your water body and the relative contributions from sources within your watershed, which of these nutrients is more important and which might be more impactful for HCB growth. With that said, it is important that you understand whether the dominant source of these nutrients in your watershed are either being externally or internally loaded. That is, external loading from a watershed means it's coming from point or non-point sources and entering the watershed, versus internal loading means that the nutrients are actually being reintroduced through the water body itself. They're already present. And depending on the depth of your water body, this internal loading may occur through a few different mechanisms. Shallow water bodies may experience internal loading due to resuspension of sediment from wave action, versus if you have a deeper water body, you can actually experience nutrient loading through chemical reactions down at the sediment surface. When oxygen levels become depleted, you can actually result in fluxes and releases of phosphorus and nitrogen. And then as the water body might turn over or get mixed, that can be introduced to higher levels where you have cyanobacteria present. So what this is all is to say is that, again, just because there's a lot of content here, we're going to be focusing on nutrient management strategies that are on this external piece. So from out of the water body or in the watershed being introduced. But I'm just going to mention here that if you want to dive more into internal loading, take a look at in-lake treatment training, which is module 4, and visit section 6 of the document. But for practical purposes, it's critical to tackle your external sources of nutrients first, or even if you stop internal loading, it's not going to do anything long-term because you'll still have those nutrients coming in. So thinking about if there is an introduction of nutrients in the watershed is really key when it comes to mitigating and preventing HCBs. So that being said, there's a lot of approaches and strategies to cover this topic. And when we were creating this document, we designed this section and web portal to assemble relevant information into one place with all these different strategies. However, there's a few basic steps that will help you organize your approach to implementing these strategies successfully. Some of these may require substantial resources, but even small amounts of data are really helpful in identifying priorities. These steps are listed here and include exploring the issue with regulatory agencies, gathering information, developing actions that secure community cooperation, determining critical areas for implementation of nutrient management strategies, implementing those strategies using the most efficient and targeted approaches, and then continually evaluating your effectiveness so that you can adapt and share lessons learned. So let's dive into step one, exploring the issue with regulatory agencies. As you're thinking about nutrient management, you want to contact your local and state agencies to determine whether nutrients have already been identified as an issue in your watershed. And if so, if watershed plans or nutrient concentration goals, something like watershed loads or site-specific criteria have already been developed. If that information is already there, that's a great place to start, and a lot of your task is already done. Along with that, once you have that information that's already been gathered, you can continue to piece together information and gather other data as needed to really characterize the relative nutrient loading in your watershed for the water body of interest. This can be done using models and monitoring if necessary. And your goal here is to identify the predominant nutrient sources in the watershed and also prioritize nutrient sources for reduction. As you're doing this, you want to leverage local knowledge, review things like permitting databases. And there's also a lot of more federal wide-scale resources available. One example is the EPA's How's My Waterway website, which I have an image of here, which is actually designed to provide information collected from states, tribes, and local agencies related to the condition of water bodies throughout the United States. You could also consider using the nutrient source tracking tool, also from the EPA, and their recovery potential screening tool, which again is designed to help assess nutrients in a water body. More information about this step and these resources are found in section 7.3, which also has these resources and some specific examples. Which then leads us to step three. Generating community support is a really critical step that is often overlooked. It's easy as resource managers to focus on the technical issues, but generating community support can assist in several key ways. First of all, a community can provide information and fill some of our data gaps that we identified in the previous steps. Community support can help find funding and funding strategies. Many of the success stories that we discovered shared the common trait of finding funding through community support. And then of course, the community can also help in implementing the project itself. When you're developing your outreach, you want to consider the individuals living in the watershed and who are stakeholders for the water body, and make sure you tailor your communication, like we talked about in the communication section, to the language, culture, interest, and background of your audience. And again, I'm going to say this a lot, but there's a lot more information available in the document. So take a look at section 7.2 for more details on this. And then step four is prioritizing your actions. You've now done a lot of background work to get to this, and this step is where those efforts will really pay off. It's also potentially the most difficult step because there are so many different actions you can take that lead to nutrient reduction. And so you really want to focus where your efforts will have the most impact. We've talked about a lot of these possible strategies and worked on bringing them into a single location with the ITRC document. And I can show you that here on the website. I'll show it to you in just a second. On the website, we have an image that categorizes a lot of these strategies. And in the scenario, I'll show you how that works and how you can pick and prioritize. Which then leads us to step five, which is the implementation. You've now gathered the data you needed, you've figured out your possibilities, you've come up with your priority, and now you need to implement your strategy. This is the fun and the exciting and the fulfilling step, what you've been working towards. And so for this, just a note, you wanna make sure that whatever you're doing to reduce nutrients, you wanna make sure that you've considered broader scale implications, and also gotten any permits you need before implementation. Okay, and then step six is monitoring in order to determine effectiveness. As mentioned in module four, we talked about that before we implement any sort of change, whether that be treatment or nutrient reduction, it's really critical to devote time to coming up with a monitoring plan to document the situation before you begin any alterations, and then to continue monitoring during any nutrient reduction and also after. This is key, particularly in seeing if what you're doing is being effective in being able to justify how you're spending money and efforts in securing future funding, and then making sure you're learning lessons to be able to carry this out in the future. And as I mentioned, so those steps are, again, broad-scaled. There is both this voluntary piece and this regulatory piece. In terms of regulation, it is helpful to remember that some nutrients can be regulated under the Clean Water Act, and there's mechanisms to achieve reductions through these means. However, because nutrients are entering the water bodies from both regulated or point sources and unregulated non-point sources, the most effective successes we've seen when it comes to nutrient reduction have a combination of both regulatory and incentive programs. So both these contributors are targeted. And so as a result, when you're getting started and coming up with your nutrient reduction plan, it's important to think about the regulatory piece and ask questions like, are there regulated nutrient goals established? Have something like total maximum daily loads or TMDLs been established? Are load allocations implemented into discharge permits for this water body, et cetera? And more information more on this regulatory piece is available in section 7.2. Okay, so we, as I just mentioned, we have these two sources of nutrients, point source and non-point source. Point source are our regulated sources. And for the sake of our document, for point sources, we're talking about sources including municipal and industrial discharge, stormwater, and then agriculture, specifically confined animal feeding operations. These are permitted point sources. Other non-point sources of nutrients that we as agencies cannot regulate directly include things like agriculture, septic wastewater management, forest management, roadway management, general runoff from urban development, and then anything that might change nutrient flux into a system. So things that may modify habitat or the hydrology of the water body, such as wetlands or shoreline. And it's interesting and helpful to think about both of these, particularly in the context as well of water quality trading. Water quality trading spans both the point and non-point categories because it's typically deployed as a tool across these nutrient source categories. The concept of water quality trading is based on the premise that sometimes nutrient control from one source may require really costly measures, while the measures to reduce the same nutrient at other sources is much less expensive. An example of this may arise when, say, treating nutrients at a point source under a regulated point source becomes prohibitively more expensive than if those same funds were deployed within the watershed at other sources that could reduce nutrients even more. Treating addresses this by allowing the greater, less costly nutrient reductions from one source to be transferred to another source where reductions may be more expensive. This flexibility allows for better outcomes at lower cost, and it promotes nutrient reduction at lower cost while advancing environmental conditions. So it can be a big win and is definitely another possibility to consider once you've made it to this step in your nutrient reduction plan, if this is a more effective and a more cost-efficient way to respond to nutrient management. Visit section 7.7 of the document to learn more about water quality trading. Okay, and then as I promised, one of the real highlights of the ITRC document when it comes to nutrient reduction is this strategy selection graphic tool, which I can show you on my mouse, shows basically a lot of really common sources of nutrients in a watershed. And when you hover over any of these red dots on the website, a pop-up will appear that provides links to strategies for reducing nutrients from that source. And this includes not only the strategy themselves, but a lot of real-life examples from around the countries. These strategies are broken into two categories as well. We have structural strategies, which incorporate some kind of physical treatment, whether that be a passive or natural, or an active and mechanical treatment, things such as sedimentation, filtration. And then as well, you can also consider strategies that are non-structural and also talked about in this document that are more programmatic, something including, you know, education or outreach, helping people make choices that prevent introducing the nutrients in the first place. As well, in addition to this graphic, we've also combined all these strategies, both structural and non-structural, for reducing nutrient pollution into this handy table, which is found in section 7.4. This is familiar to some of the other tables we've already covered in this training, but you'll see we have a lot of different sources, different land types, and then some descriptions about where these sources may come from and how they affect nutrient loading in a system. Okay, so fabulous tool. Let's talk about how we could use this in our hypothetical scenario. And again, because there's a lot to this process, we're mostly going to focus on the objectives of step 4 in nutrient reduction, which is the step of identifying and prioritizing strategies. So trying to figure out where in this scenario do we really want to focus our efforts in reducing nutrients. So here's Largeville Reservoir that we've seen already today, the semi-urban lake. And Largeville actually includes both point and non-point sources of nutrients in its watershed. It's a popular recreational use area, and it's also a source of drinking water. I've highlighted this rural water intake here at the northern end of the lake. HCBs at Largeville threaten both recreation and drinking water uses. And particularly in this scenario, we're going to talk about how at this rural water intake, we're annually receiving reports of taste and odor issues. And these reports tend to co-occur whenever HCBs are reported in the area. So let's take a look and see maybe how we could reduce nutrients to prevent this from occurring in the future. If we zoom out a little bit, I'll recircle that rural water intake so you can orient yourself. We can look upstream and identify several potential nutrient sources. First of all, up here we have Farmtown, which has a number of feedlots. So these confined animal feeding operations that certainly could contribute nutrients to the area. And then over here we have the town of Smallburg and Smallburg Lake. Smallburg Lake, as we've talked about, has also HCBs occurring in a number of sources of nutrients. And you also see underneath Smallburg, we have one wastewater treatment plant. However, that actually enters Largeville below the rural water intake of concern and is actually, in this case, less likely to be a major contributor of some of the nutrient overloading we're seeing up here. Instead, if we zoom in a little bit here to Smallburg, Rob just walked us through the situation there. We have a number of sources of nutrient input that could end up affecting our rural intake. We have a lot of waterfowl around Goose Island. We have housing developments and runoff. A lot of septic systems can also introduce nutrients. So a lot of potential sources here that we're going to want to explore as we come up with our nutrient reduction strategy. So now that we've identified these possibilities, we can then dive a little bit more into the tool through the ITRC website. So say we want to focus on septic systems and then these feedlots, we could select both of these on the tool, pops up this window that has hyperlinks to information about both. Say we take a look, first of all, at septic systems, that would take us to this documentation. That's really helpful, provides information about how septic systems can introduce nutrients into a water body with lots of resources, and then dives into strategies, both structural and non-structural, so active and versus more educational, that we could consider taking to reduce nutrients from those septic systems. Or, you know, if instead we use the tool to dive into the feedlots, this is a little bit farther down on the feedlot page. And you can see this documentation also includes things such as pros and cons of different approaches. regulatory considerations, et cetera. So certainly way too many resources here for me to go through each one. You can imagine that using this tool really allows you to explore nutrient sources as you're considering where you want to focus your efforts in nutrient reduction. So that's what we would do here in this hypothetical scenario. And what I would certainly invite you to do is you're thinking about your water body of interest. One amendum to that, Gina, when she was giving the introduction, talked about how our climate is changing. And that is a challenge when it comes to mitigating and preventing cyanobacteria blooms. The component we can change is nutrients. We can't change how climate might be altering, at least individually and directly for our water bodies. And so we need to consider that it makes sometimes preventing these blooms challenging, but also makes reducing nutrients in our waterways particularly critical. Because that is the one wheel we can turn. As well, I think Lake Erie, for example, is a story about how considering both these regulated point sources and unregulated non-point sources is really critical in preventing HCBs and considering nutrient management. Lake Erie was really affected by the Clean Water Act, and a lot of point discharges were reduced, which really improved the nutrient loading in the lake. However, while that improved things on the short term, later on, non-point sources of nutrients re-threw the system out of balance, which again just emphasizes that idea that we have to be thinking about this holistically and looking for opportunities to reduce nutrients throughout the entire watershed, not just what we can regulate with law, but also using incentives. And then just a few final thoughts when it comes to nutrient reduction. I think there also are a lot of success stories, though, and really this is our best approach for having lasting impacts on improving our water bodies and mitigating HCBs, and so encourage this group to pursue a long-term effort to reduce excess nutrients from these prioritized at-risk water bodies. And it's not easy. I have Perseverance Rover here photographed or photo of it or image of it. That is what it takes, is perseverance and ongoing efforts and patience to slowly reduce nutrients in our water bodies. And we certainly also want to keep hearing your success stories and learning from your efforts. So make sure to document and to share those successes. That's all I have. I'm going to turn this back over to Devin.
All right. Thank you so much, Hannah and Rob, for delivering those two, those great modules here today. So we're going to finish up with a Q&A, and then I will wrap up with just some logistics for everybody. So with that, I'll look right to our Q&A pod, and I'm going to read off those questions for our trainers. Is food web manipulation referring to biological control, such as using organisms that eat the bloom, such as rotifers and other predatory organisms? A potential negative about chemical control is the possibility of killing the bacteria in large amounts and releasing toxins all at once.
This is Gina. I'll cover that question. Yes, you're correct. When we're talking about food web manipulation, usually in North America, excuse me, I've got to get a drink of water. Sorry about that, was coughing. Usually in North America, it means introducing predatory fish that then eat planktivorous fish in order to increase the number of zooplankton that then graze on cyanobacteria.
All right, thank you, Gina. Next question. What forms or species of nitrogens are more important indicators? Total nitrogen, TKN, and I apologize, I am not a science buff, so I'm going to read these acronyms out all the way. NO2, NO3, NH4, dissolved. Total phosphate or orthophosphate, et cetera. I know that Hannah and Rob had some thoughts on this, and I do apologize for misspeaking any of those acronyms there.
It's all good, Devin. I can try to take a stab at answering this one. So it doesn't seem like there's any one good indicator. There's some emerging science which shows that particularly for nitrogen, the species seems to be driving some of the toxin production because the toxins are by and large nitrogen containing compounds. So like nitrate, ammonia seem to be really affecting the ability of the cells to produce toxins. But it also might be very situational for the water body as a whole. So, in terms of monitoring, traditionally total nitrogen, total phosphorus are monitored to sort of gauge the nutrient load that's in the water system, or in the sample. But, the more that you can sort of monitor and the more frequencies that you can, more sampling events you can include, the better you can understand the dynamics that might be driving the population and understand. So we see oligotrophic systems that don't have high nutrient loading that tend to have, can have blooms. And then we see, hypereutrophic systems that don't have, really high intense blooms. So it doesn't seem like it's, solely nutrient driven as in so much as it could be some of the other factors that were discussed before, like stillness of water, temperature, predation, so on and so forth. So there's really no one good indicator species that will dictate whether a bloom is going to occur, what species is going to be there, or if that bloom is going to be toxin producing or not.
Right, thank you, Rob. Next question. Can HCBs be introduced into bodies of water from recreational boats or canoes?
Yeah, I can take this one. That's a great question and certainly a concept we think of a lot with things like zebra mussels. However, in terms of cyanobacteria, these species, cyanobacteria occur naturally in every water body in the world. And so generally bloom-forming species are already there and can actually be very healthy and a really important part of the ecology in low levels. The problem occurs when we create these environments that allow them to bloom and really thrive and their populations to go from low healthy levels to dominating the entire system. So the cyanobacteria is already there. It's more, are we creating an environment where they can bloom or not?
Great. Thank you, Hannah. So that wraps up our last Q&A section for today. So I'm just going to wrap up the full training with just some logistics here. I would just like to remind everybody that we do have a second part to this training focused on HCB benthics. That will be on March 9th from 1 o'clock to 3:15 p.m. Eastern. You are able to register for that on the Kluin training page that brought you to this training, as well as the two are connected. I would also just like to remind everybody that we do have feedback forms available for completion, which is also how you would obtain a certificate of completion if you require any proof of continuing education units. So if you go to the Kluin training page that brought you here, there will be a feedback form section a little bit lower on the page. And if you click that and fill it out and click the box to certify that you participated, a certificate will be emailed to you. Beyond just the certificate, we would love to hear your feedback and thoughts on today's training. So we would encourage you to fill out that feedback form regardless of your interest in a certificate. And I would just also like to throw out there that we do archive all of our trainings, and we do hope that you will explore any additional training opportunities on Kluin on their archive trainings page. And with that, I would just like to thank our attendees and thank our expert trainers here for being not only volunteering their time to make this document possible, but also this training course. And thank you to our attendees for taking the time to be here with us today and for putting those great questions in the Q&A pod. So with that, I wish you all a great rest of your day and wrap up the training here today. Thank you.